6. Greed saved the whales, not Greenpeace. 1. Greenpeace and the whales. If anything qualifies as a miracle of nature, it's the blue whale. As a baby, it gains 10 pounds an hour drinking its mother's milk. It takes 10 years to achieve maturity. Full grown, the blue whale is the largest known creature to have graced Earth, nearly 3 times bigger than the biggest dinosaur. A single blue whale can stretch 10 stories long and weigh as much as the National Football League. While we know much more about them than we did 50 years ago, whales remain mysterious and mystical. We know humpbacks work together to blow air bubbles to trap schools of herring and other fish in a sphere before lunging upward, mouths open to gorge themselves. But we don't know whether they use acoustics, the stars, Earth's magnetic fields, or some other means of navigating from Hawaii to Alaska every year. Indigenous people reportedly treated whales with reverence. In Vietnam, those who set off to sea prayed to the whale, addressing the creature as Ngai, or Lord, a tradition that continues today. Fishermen accord an elaborate funeral upon the beached whale, equal to one they would give a king. In one version of the Inuit creation tale, a fisherman who finds a beached whale is told by the Great Spirit to eat magic mushrooms to gain the strength needed to return the whale to the sea and restore order to the world. But by the mid-20th century, with the rise of massive industrial ships, humans nearly hunted whales to extinction. Scientists raised the alarm about declining whale stocks, and a small group of committed young activists set out to save them. The activists started documenting the brutality of whaling and the humanity of whales. Things came to a boil in the summer of 1975. A small group of anti-whaling activists left the port of Vancouver on a 66-foot halibut fishing boat. They headed to a whaling region in the North Pacific, where they intended to confront Russian whalers. Once there, the activists boarded their Zodiac, a high-speed inflatable boat, and drove between a Soviet catcher vessel, the Vlastny, and a pod of sperm whales. An activist gripped his Super 8 camera with anticipation. The Vlastny's cannon boomed, and a 250-pound grenade harpoon whizzed past the bearded activists. It slammed into the back of a small female humpback. One of the young men involved in the 1975 Vancouver incident later described the confrontation with the whalers. "The whale wavered and towered motionless above us. I looked up past the daggered 6-inch teeth into a massive eye, an eye the size of my fist, an eye that reflected back an intelligence, an eye that spoke wordlessly of compassion, an eye that communicated that this whale could discriminate and understood what we had tried to do. On that day, I knew emotionally and spiritually that my allegiance lay with the whales first and foremost over the interests of the humans that would kill them." A few nights later, Walter Cronkite aired the Zodiac crew members' Super 8 footage on CBS Evening News, and millions of people would learn the name of the new organization, Greenpeace. After another 7 years of media publicity, grassroots organizing, and political pressure, in 1982, environmental activists successfully inspired the world to impose a complete ban on commercial whaling. Today, whales of all species, including the mighty blue, are rebounding in numbers. 2. Grand ball given by the whales. The story of a small band of committed nature lovers saving the environment appeals to us. It is the story we learn from TV and movie documentaries, books and news reports. It is an exciting drama with obvious heroes and villains. On one side, there are greedy, cowardly people destroying nature for profit, and on the other side, there are idealistic, brave youth. It is a story that has inspired millions to take action. The only problem with it as a guide for protecting the environment is that nearly everything about it is wrong. Whatever reverence some traditions have for whales, Humans around the world have mostly treated them as prey and sought to eat them, not worship them. The Inuits may have freed beached whales, but they also survived by hunting them. In the early 1600s, an English explorer observed Native Americans whaling around what is now Cape Cod, Massachusetts. "They go in company of their king," he wrote, "with a multitude of their boats and strike him with a bone made in fashion of a harping iron fastened to a rope, harpoon. After shooting the whale with arrows and then drowning it or bleeding it out, the Indians would return to shore with it and sing a song of joy." A Jesuit explorer from Spain described a daring team of indigenous warriors in what is now Florida. They paddled in their canoes right up next to a whale. Then, one commando leaped atop the mammal and thrust his spear into its blowhole. At that moment, the Jesuit claims, the animal plunged into the sea. Upon surfacing, the man was hanging on for dear life, stabbing the creature to death. Organized whaling is at least as old as the 8th century. It was then that the Basque people in what is now Spain built towers to spot them and hunt them. In 17th century Japan, during the same decade, 6 companies formed a consortium to hunt whales. 10 to 12 boats would form a semicircle and drop a net to trap whales close to shore. The climax was reached when one of the men administered the coup de grace with a long sword, writes a historian. As in bullfighting, these whaling toreadors were celebrated as national heroes. In 18th and 19th century United States, whales were hunted in open sail ships. Once a whale was spotted, 2 groups of 6 men, each in a small boat, were lowered into the sea. They would quietly row next to their target. When the small rowboats were rubbing right up next to their prey, wood to black skin, one of the men hurled a harpoon. Typically, the whale would bolt ahead, dragging the men along for the ride of their lives. Eventually, the whale would tire, at which point the men would pull next to it, drive a sharp steel lance into its lungs, and then twist it. Other times, whales plunged into the abyss, dragging their human predators to their death. Sometimes men killed whales easily, and other times, "She will hold the whale men in play near half a day together with their lances," a naturalist in 1725 wrote, "and sometimes will get away after they have been lanced and spouted blood." A geyser of blood from the whale's blowhole would excite the men. "Chimneys afire!" men would shout. By 1830, the United States was the global whaling leader. Whale oil was a luxury commodity because it burned brighter than candles and cleaner than wood fires. Whales provided much else: food, soap, machine lubricants, the base oil for perfume, and from their baleen, corsets, umbrellas, and fishing rods. Rising demand for whale oil led entrepreneurs to look for alternatives. One of them was named Samuel Keir. In 1849, a doctor prescribed Keir's wife American medicinal oil, petroleum, to treat an illness. His idea wasn't new. The Iroquois had used petroleum as an insect repellent, salve, and tonic for hundreds of years. When his wife felt better, Keir recognized a business opportunity. He launched his own brand, Keir's Petroleum or Rock Oil, and sold bottles for 50 cents through a sales force traveling through the region by wagon. Keir was ambitious and sought other uses for his product. A chemist recommended distilling it and using it as lighting fluid. Keir's contribution to the emerging petroleum revolution was the creation of the first industrial-scale refinery in downtown Pittsburgh. A group of New York investors believed Keir had created a major business opportunity. They hired an itinerant and disabled engineer with good expertise in salt drilling to poke around in Pennsylvania for petroleum. In 1859, the man, Edwin Drake, drilled and hit a gusher of oil near Titusville, Pennsylvania. The discovery of the Drake Well led to widespread production of petroleum-based kerosene, which rapidly took over the market for lighting fluids in the United States, thus saving whales, which were no longer needed for their oil. At its peak, whaling produced 600,000 barrels of whale oil annually. The petroleum industry achieved that level less than 3 years after Drake's oil strike. In a single day, one Pennsylvania well produced as much oil as it took a whaling voyage 3 or 4 years to obtain, a dramatic example of petroleum's high power density. In 1861, 2 years after Drake's oil strike, Vanity Fair magazine published a cartoon showing sperm whales standing on their fins and dressed in tuxedos and ball gowns, toasting one another with champagne at a fine celebration. The caption read, "Grand ball given by the whales to celebrate the discovery of the oil wells in Pennsylvania." While whalers overhunted whales, historians conclude that there is no evidence that American whaling contracted because of a serious shortage of whales. The creation of a substitute with a much higher power density was sufficient. This is an important lesson, since it means we need not wait for inferior products, environmentally and otherwise, to run out before replacing them. 3. How Congo Saved the Whales. As fate would have it, capitalism would save the whales not once, but twice. By 1900, whaling looked like a dying industry. U.S. whaling output was less than 10% of its peak. The only reason whaling didn't disappear altogether is that Norwegians were able to continue whaling certain species at low costs, and because of continuing demand for whalebone or baleen. People hadn't yet invented petroleum-based plastics to substitute for baleen, the material taken from the underside of whale mouths, which people prized for its plasticity. But then, whaling came back, and in a big way. Between 1904 and 1978, whalers killed 1 million whales, nearly 3 times more than had been harvested during the 19th century. A series of breakthroughs made whale oil newly useful for different products. In 1905, European chemists invented a way to turn liquid oil into solid fat for making soap. The process was called hydrogenation because it involved blowing hydrogen gas over nickel fillings into the oil. Then, in 1918, chemists discovered how to solidify whale oil while eliminating the smell and taste, allowing it to be used for the first time as margarine. But then, industrial chemists succeeded in making margarine almost entirely from palm oil, eliminating the need for whale oil. By 1940, palm oil, much of it coming from the Congo, had become cheaper than whale oil. Between 1938 and 1951, the use of vegetable oils used for margarine quadrupled, while the use of whale and fish oil declined by 2/3. The share of whale oil as an ingredient in soap fell from 13% to just 1%. Whale oil as a share of global trade in fats declined from 9.4% in the 1930s to 1.7% in 1958, resulting in declining whale oil prices in the late 1950s. Journalists realized what was going on. In 1959, the New York Times reported that the growing output of vegetable oils has forced down the market value of whale oil and may, in the end, save the whales. By 1968, Norwegian whalers were reduced to selling whale meat to pet food manufacturers. The Times reported that the market for once prized whale oil has slipped from $238 a ton in 1966 to $101.50. It is lost out to Peruvian fish oil and African vegetable oils. This time, rising scarcity of whales did incentivize their replacement with vegetable oil. A group of economists concluded that economic growth brought with it a declining demand for whale products, whilst decreasing stock levels fed back into more and more expensive harvesting effort. Whaling peaked in 1962, a full 13 years before Greenpeace's heavily publicized action in Vancouver, and declined dramatically during the next decade. The United Nations called for a 10-year moratorium in 1972, and the United States banned whaling under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. By 1975, the year of Greenpeace's celebrated Vancouver Action, an international agreement between 46 nations which prohibited all hunting of the humpback, the blue whale, the gray whale, and some species of right, fin, and sei whales was already in place. It was vegetable oil, not an international treaty, that saved the whales. 99% of all whales killed in the 20th century had occurred by the time the International Whaling Commission, IWC, got around to imposing a moratorium in 1982. The commission's moratorium on whaling in the 1980s, according to the economists who did the most careful study, was a rubber stamp on a situation that had already emerged. Regulation was not important in stabilizing populations. The International Whaling Commission set whaling quotas, but they weren't low enough to prevent overwhaling. In theory, the IWC was meant to regulate the killing of whales. In practice, the IWC functioned more like an international hunting club. Concludes the leading historian of the period, the 30 years of work by the IWC have proven a fiasco. Those nations that thundered the loudest against whaling after the Greenpeace action didn't themselves hunt whales. Strong anti-whaling positions became a rather convenient way of portraying a green image, as virtually no material costs were involved for nations without whaling interests. Rising prosperity and wealth created the demand for the substitutes that saved the whales. People saved the whales by no longer needing them, and they no longer needed them because they had created more abundant, cheaper, and better alternatives. Today, the populations of blue whales, humpback whales, and bowheads, three species for which there is great concern, are all recovering, albeit slowly, as is to be expected due to their large size and thus slow rate of reproduction. Not a single whale species is at risk of extinction. Nations harvest fewer than 2,000 whales annually, an amount that is 97% less than the nearly 75,000 whales killed in 1960. The moral of the story, for the economists who studied how vegetable oil saved the whales, was that, to some extent, economies can outgrow severe environmental exploitation. 4. A system without a schedule. While consulting for General Electric in the early 1970s, a playful 40-something-year-old Italian nuclear physicist named Cesare Marchetti became friendly with one of GE's in-house economists. The man had recently co-authored a paper, A Simple Substitution Model of Technological Change. The model calculated how quickly new products became suitable replacements for older ones in order to predict how quickly new products would saturate the market. For a company like GE, with many different technology products, having such a model could be valuable. Marchetti did not ordinarily think much of economic modeling. As an old-time physicist, he wrote, I always had the tendency to tease my economist friends for their supreme ability to construct beautifully structured models that will never be used in practice and will never be splattered with the mud of this low world. This time was different. The GE economists were plugging actual data into the model to see if it worked. I was impressed by the fact that the model was sloshing joyfully in the mud, Marchetti wrote. He was so taken with the model that he took it with him when he left GE to work at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, IASA, a rare research collaboration funded by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, in 1974. The United States and Soviet Union created IASA as a means for scientific cooperation to bring the communist East and capitalist West closer together. It was focused on breaking down barriers, not just between nations, but between disciplines. IASA pioneered an interdisciplinary approach to systems analysis, a version of which would later be adopted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC. The picture of evolution as a series of replacements inspired Marchetti. For much of his life, he has collected typewriters, from some of the first models to some of the last, an extension of his fascination with technological innovation as a kind of Darwinian evolution. At Yasa, Marchetti tested the replacement or substitution model on primary sources of energy, which he treated like commodities competing for a market. By primary energy, Marchetti meant those natural resources or fuels that can be used in a variety of ways, namely wood, coal, petroleum, natural gas, and uranium. Secondary energies, by contrast, are things like electricity, kerosene, hydrogen, LPG, and gasoline, which must be made from primary energies. Throughout the next summer, Marchetti and a colleague inputted data from 300 cases of energy transitions from around the world. The transitions were from wood to coal, whale oil to petroleum, coal to oil, and many other combinations. "I could not believe my eyes," he wrote, "but it worked." He added, "The whole destiny of an energy source seems to be completely predetermined in the first childhood." The study of what we today call energy transitions was born. Wars, big changes in energy prices, and even depressions, Marchetti found, had no effect on the rate of energy transition. "It is as though the system had a schedule, a will, and a clock," he wrote. Older histories emphasized the role of scarcity in raising prices and stimulating innovation, such as how Europeans had to import wood from increasingly distant forests, making it more expensive, and the newcomer fuel, coal, relatively cheaper. But Marchetti found that the market regularly moved away from a certain primary energy source long before it was exhausted, at least at world level. While scarcity helps incentivize entrepreneurs like Drake's investors to create alternatives, it is often rising economic growth and rising demand for a specific energy service, like lighting, transportation, heat, or industry, that allows fossil fuels to replace renewables and oil and gas to replace coal. That's what happened with whales. Other substitutes, principally hog fat and ethanol, emerged before the discovery of oil fields in Pennsylvania and the distillation of petroleum into kerosene. It was petroleum's abundance and superior power density that ultimately led to its triumph over biofuels. Coal started declining as a share of energy around World War I, even though coal reserves were in a sense infinite, as oil and natural gas started to replace it. Energy transitions have occurred in the way that Marchetti predicted, from more energy-dilute and carbon-dense fuels toward more energy-dense and hydrogen-dense ones. Just as coal is twice as energy-dense as wood, petroleum is more energy-dense than coal, as is natural gas when converted to liquid form. The chemistry is simple to understand. Coal is comprised of roughly one carbon atom for every hydrogen atom. Petroleum is comprised of one carbon atom for every two hydrogen atoms. And natural gas, or rather its main component, methane, has four hydrogen atoms to one carbon atom, hence its molecular expression as CH4. As a consequence of these energy transitions, the carbon intensity of energy has declined for more than 150 years. Between 1860 and the mid-1990s, the carbon intensity of primary global energy declined about 0.3% per year. Marchetti was right that human societies tend to move from energy dilute to energy dense fuels, but wrong that the system had a schedule and a clock. While the direction of energy transitions, he predicted, was broadly correct, Marchetti's timing was off. For example, in the United States, the share of electricity coming from coal declined from more than 45% in 2010 to just less than 25% in 2019. Europe saw similarly large declines in electricity from coal and increases from natural gas during the last two decades. Marchetti predicted the coal-to-gas transition would occur in the 1980s and 1990s, and was thus two decades off. and he optimistically predicted that few humans would, by today, still be burning wood and other forms of biomass, where in reality more than 2.5 billion people still do. What determines the rate of those transitions is politics, and, as we will see, sometimes politics can move societies away from energy-dense fuels and back toward more energy-dilute ones. 5. The Gasland Deception. In spring 2010, a documentary filmmaker released a trailer to his new film, Gasland, about the natural gas boom in the United States. The background music, similar to what we hear in trailers for horror fantasy movies, grows in volume and speed. We hear people say that hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, of shale, an underground rock formation, is poisoning their water and causing neurological diseases and brain lesions. It shows documents describing lung disease and cancer. 3/4 into the trailer, we hear an ominous chorus typical of what you might expect to hear when dragons take flight. A man stands by his sink with a handwritten sign above it reading, "Do not drink this water." We then see a congressman with a southern accent saying, with frustration in his voice, "What we're doing is searching for a problem that does not exist." The trailer then cuts back to the man at the sink. He is holding a lit cigarette lighter near the faucet's tap, which he turns on, igniting huge flames that force him to jump backward. The New York Times and other national media picked up on the story and depicted fracking for natural gas as a significant threat to America's natural environment, helping spawn a grassroots movement to end the practice. But the film's depiction of the flammable water was deceptive. In 2008 and 2009, the man from the film and two other Colorado residents filed formal complaints to Colorado's main oil and gas regulator, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The commission took water samples from the three homes and sent them to a private laboratory. The laboratory found that the gas from the man's faucet and one other home was 100% biogenic, or natural, and something people have safely dealt with for decades. It was created not by frackers, but by Mother Nature. The third home had a mixture of biogenic and thermogenic methane. The owner and operator reached a settlement in the case. The independent regulator of Colorado's oil and gas industry took sharp objection to Gasland, noting that it informed producer Josh Fox of the facts of the cases well before he produced his movie, and he chose not to include them. People have documented water catching fire naturally for centuries. There are reports of water on fire dating back to the ancient Greeks, Indians, and Persians. We now know that they were naturally occurring methane seeps. In 1889, a driller burned his beard after lighting water from a well he drilled in Colfax, Louisiana. There's a historical marker at the site of the well, which was featured in Ripley's Believe It or Not. An Irish documentary filmmaker named Phelim MacAleer called out Fox for his mischaracterization of fracking at a 2011 Gasland screening. MacAleer: "There's a flaming water report from 1976. Fox: "Well, I don't care about the report from 1976. There were reports from 1936 that people say they can light their water on fire in New York State." MacAleer: "I'm curious why you didn't include relevant reports from 1976 or from 1936 in the documentary. Most people watching your film would think that lighting your water started with fracking. You have said yourself people lit their water long before fracking started, isn't that correct?" Fox: "Yes, but it's not relevant." The Irish filmmaker posted the exchange on YouTube. Fox alleged copyright infringement. At first, YouTube obeyed Fox's demand and removed the video, before eventually restoring it. 6. Fracking the climate. For nearly a decade, climate activists led by Bill McKibben of 350.org have claimed that natural gas is worse for the climate than coal. And yet, on virtually every metric, natural gas is cleaner than coal. Natural gas emits 17 to 40 times less sulfur dioxide, a fraction of the nitrous oxide that coal emits, and almost no mercury. Natural gas is 1/8 as deadly as coal, counting both accidents and air pollution. And burning gas rather than coal for electricity requires 25 to 50 times less water. The technological revolution allowing for firms to extract far more natural gas from shale and the ocean floor is the main reason that U.S. carbon emissions from energy declined 13% between 2005 and 2018, and a big part of the reason why global temperatures are unlikely to rise more than 3 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. McKibben makes his claim that coal is better than natural gas by using an inappropriately short time frame for global warming of just 20 years. The United States government and most experts agree that the appropriate time frame to use is 100 years. His time frame thus exaggerates the impact of natural gas as a heat-trapping gas. Despite a nearly 40% increase in natural gas production since 1990, the EPA reported a 20% decrease in methane emissions in 2013, in part because of improved gaskets, monitoring, and maintenance. Natural gas fracking also resulted in a 62% decline in the mountaintop mining for coal between 2008 and 2014. Where fracking for natural gas cracks shale below the Earth's surface, imposing very small impacts above ground, coal mining devastates mountain ecosystems. More than 500 mountains, covering more than 1 million acres, have been destroyed in central and southern Appalachia by mountaintop removal. When mining companies demolish mountains with explosives to harvest coal, they dump millions of tons of crushed rock into nearby valleys, destroying forests and headway streams. Exposed rock leaches heavy metals and other toxins, which hurt wildlife, insects, and humans. Dust that blows into the air from such operations can harm miners and people who live in nearby communities. No energy transition occurs without human and environmental impacts. Fracking brings pipelines, rigs, and trucks, which can disrupt peaceful landscapes that people rightly care about. Frackers have created small earthquakes and improperly disposed of fracking wastewater. These problems are serious and should be addressed, but they are nowhere as bad as coal mining, which has in many ways become worse throughout the decades, not better, culminating in mountaintop removal and the destruction of river ecosystems. What explains the lower environmental impact of natural gas fracking as compared to coal mining is power density. A natural gas field in the Netherlands is 3 times more power dense than the world's most productive coal mines. Today, many, if not most scientists and environmentalists, support natural gas as a substitute for coal. People are placing too much emphasis on methane, climate scientist Ray Pierrembert told the Washington Post. People should prove that we can actually get the CO2 emissions down first, before worrying about whether we are doing enough to get methane emissions down. Pollution regulations helped make coal plants more expensive to build and operate, but as Marchetti predicted, and similar to what we saw with whales, what mattered most was the creation of a more power-dense, abundant, and cheaper alternative. What Marchetti didn't foresee was how powerful and important opposition to the new technology, particularly from upper classes of society, could be in the case of energy transitions. 7. Fish go wild. In late 2015, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved a genetically modified salmon, one that delivered major environmental benefits over existing farmed salmon. Critics loved it. "The flesh is exquisite," wrote one food writer. "Buttery, light, juicy, just as Atlantic salmon should be." The Aqua Advantage salmon, developed by Aqua Bounty Technologies in 1989, grows twice as fast and needs 20% less feed than Atlantic salmon, While 8 pounds of feed is needed to harvest 1 pound of beef, only 1 pound of feed is required for 1 pound of Aqua Advantage salmon. Unlike the majority of farmed salmon, which is produced in floating sea cages in coastal areas, Aqua Advantage is produced in hatcheries and facilities and warehouses on land. It thus minimizes the impact of aquaculture on natural ocean environments and prevents harmful interactions with wild species, which can result in disease. And Aqua Bounty estimates it will produce 23 to 25% fewer carbon emissions than traditionally farmed salmon. Atlantic salmon is already one of the world's healthiest foods. It is low in calories and saturated in trans fats, and a good source of protein and omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids. By genetically altering the salmon, Aqua Bounty also eliminated the need for antibiotics, which public health officials warn can contribute to antibiotic resistance. Aqua Advantage salmon is as safe to eat as any non-genetically engineered Atlantic salmon, and also as nutritious, the FDA says. Fish farming is critical for saving wild fish and other marine species, such as the yellow-eyed penguins and the albatross. That's because the total population of ocean fish that humans hunt and eat for food has declined by nearly 40% since 1970. Overfishing has resulted in many local extinctions, including of sharks. Today, 90% of the world's fish stocks are either overfished or at capacity, meaning they are close to or just barely above the maximum they can be harvested before seeing their populations collapse entirely. Where 15% of Earth's land surface is protected, just less than 8% of the world's oceans are. Since 1974, humankind has tripled the share of fish stocks being harvested at unsustainable levels, and the pressure on wild fish continues to rise. Between now and 2050, thanks to rising wealth and a growing number of people, global demand for fish is expected to double. The good news is that fish farming, or aquaculture, is developing rapidly. Aquaculture output doubled between 2000 and 2014, and today it produces half of all fish for human consumption. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, reported in 2018 that aquaculture continues to grow faster than other major food production sector, and that by 2030, the world will eat 20% more fish than in 2016. A big environmental benefit from aquaculture comes from moving fish farms from oceans to land. Doing so reduces their impact on marine environments and allows for closed or near-closed systems where water is constantly being cleaned and recycled. The technologies pioneered to create genetically engineered fish bring side benefits. Scientists say such genetic modification offers the possibility of eliminating the deadly avian flu virus. And yet, the most outspoken critics of replacing wild fish consumption with farmed fish are environmental groups, including the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, and Sierra Club, which claimed Aqua Advantage salmon might contaminate populations of wild salmon. After the FDA approved Aqua Advantage, the head of the Center for Food Safety, another environmental group, announced it was filing a lawsuit to stop the introduction of this dangerous contaminant. In response, several large supermarket chains, including Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, announced they would not carry the Aqua Bounty fish, even though spokespersons from both chains admitted the stores offer other foods produced with genetically modified ingredients or feed. Fish farming is not without its problems. Early fish farms, such as shrimp farms, were quite destructive, involving the clearing of mangrove forests and the pollution of waterways by chemicals and nutrients. But, over time, their negative environmental impact has significantly declined, through better sighting of fish and shrimp farms and the co-farming of species such as scallops and mussels with seaweed and microalgae. The scientist who first raised the concern that genetically engineered fish could threaten wild fish stocks is today one of its most outspoken advocates. I won't argue that a genetically engineered salmon will never find its way into the ocean, he said. But there's nothing in this fish that would last more than a single generation because of its low fitness. As for Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, former Aqua Bounty CEO Ron Stadish was optimistic that he could change their minds. We are hopeful that over time they will embrace our product. But 5 years later, neither the environmental groups supposedly worried about the future of wild fish, nor Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, Costco, Kroger, and Target had changed their minds. 8. Class War. Today, Cesare Marchetti is in his early 90s and lives as a gentleman farmer near Florence, says his friend and co-author Jesse Ossible, with olive groves, grapevines, goats, black cats, and his typewriter collection. Ossible, who works at Woods Hole Research Institute and Rockefeller University, has been friends with Marchetti since they met in the 1970s at Yasa. Today, the two men are trying to sequence the genome of Leonardo da Vinci out of trace DNA they've been able to gather from the books and other items that belonged to the great Renaissance artist. If you look at da Vinci's drawings of storms and clouds, he understood the immense indifference of nature, said Ossible, and a lot of the human enterprise. I asked Ossible why he thought Marchetti's model of energy transitions had been so off in terms of timing, even if it was broadly accurate on the direction. You can look at the long term and the dynamics when, he said, but you can look at any phenomenon and find interruptions, hiatus, digressions, and diversions. That's what happened with energy. Opposition to the new fuel usually comes from the wealthy. In Britain, elites called coal the devil's excrement, something that many people believed to be literally true, given its sulfuric smell. Coal smoke smelled bad against the sweet smell of wood burning. The upper class of Victorian England resisted the transition from wood to coal as long as they could. It was educated elites who similarly waged the war on fracking. The key antagonists were the New York Times, Bill McKibben, and well-financed environmental groups, including the Sierra Club and Natural Resources Defense Council. Ossible describes how coal interests fought against greater exploration of natural gas in the 1970s. People fight tenaciously to hold on to their position. That was true in the U.S. of the coal industry, which developed an alliance between, in the West, Republican Senator Alan Simpson in Wyoming, and in the East, Democratic Senator Robert Byrd in West Virginia. At the national political level, they were able to do a lot of things that superannuated the coal industry. Ossible pointed to the election of President Jimmy Carter in 1976, who, with the support of major environmental groups, pushed for more coal instead of nuclear and natural gas. Ossible believes the concern about energy independence in the 1970s was misplaced. He said that the worries that exporting gas would somehow hurt our national security were insane. In fact, having a healthy large industry gives you more national power. Ossible notes that scientists knew natural gas was abundant, particularly in the oceans. Everybody in the American Association of Petroleum Geologists by the early to mid-80s knew there were vast amounts of gas offshore on the continental margins and the methane hydrates. I wrote about them in a 1983 National Academy of Sciences report. Geologists allowed the idea to persist that natural gas was precious and that you had to save it because there wasn't that much of it. Today, the oil and gas majors see themselves as natural gas more than petroleum companies going forward. But in many places, that could have happened 20 to 30 years ago and didn't. Happily, the war on fracking failed. When it came to fracking shale for natural gas, the United States interfered less than other countries and benefited enormously as a result. The United States allows property owners the mining and drilling rights to the earth beneath them. In most other nations, those rights belong to the government, which is a major reason why fracking hasn't taken off in other countries. Politics even interfered with saving the whales. While environmentalists often blame capitalism for environmental problems, it was communism that made whaling worse than it needed to be. After the fall of communism, historians found records that the Soviet Union was whaling at far higher numbers than they had admitted. It did so even though it was no longer profitable to do so, thanks to Soviet central planning. 98% of the blue whales killed globally after the ban in 1966 were killed by Soviet whalers, wrote a historian, as were 92% of the 1,201 humpbacks killed commercially between 1967 and 1978. And had there been freer markets, nations like Japan and Norway might have switched from whale oil to vegetable oil much sooner. What probably sustains the whaling industry against the inroads of vegetable oil, reported the New York Times in 1959, is the desire of the whaling nations to conserve their foreign exchange. In general, they do not produce enough vegetable oil for their own needs, and hence must either catch whales or buy fats and oil abroad. The moral of the story is that economic growth and the rising demand for food, lighting, and energy drive product and energy transitions, but politics can constrain them. Energy transitions depend on people wanting them. When it comes to protecting the environment by moving to superior alternatives, public attitudes and political action matter.